please take that off the turntable? I'm a very busy disc jockey now. Go away. Hello, it's me again. Pin back your ear holes and listen to this lot.
English lesson. You learned by listening. After that, you began to imitate those sounds.
Testing. Hey, is this thing on? Testing. Can we have a round of applause for DJ?
Format.
But nonetheless, yeah, it gets to Interstellar. So how's the universe really put together? Because, you know, like through Halton Arp's work, is it, you know, redshifts definitely don't denote distance. You know, that's pretty sure at this point, if you're looking at the electric universe, you know, especially with quasars. You know, quasars are, you know, quasi-stellar objects. They're proto-galaxies that are emitted from the centers of galaxies when they're undergoing galactic core eruptions, which all galaxies do periodically. Say our galaxy, you know, say, you used to think, well, it was every, what, 100 million years, 200 million years, whatever. But now they're thinking, like Paul LaViolette's work, the galactic core could erupt like every 12 to 24,000 years, which actually seems key to the precessional cycle.
Right.
Our precessional cycle is supposedly like, you know, let's say 24, 26,000 years. They say 26,000 and there's all the math that works out with it, but at the same time, it's a nonlinear rate. It's being measured, so we really don't know. So I'd say 24,000 because I like that number. But let's say 26,000, and supposedly we're 26,000 light years from the center of the galaxy.
Right.
John Jenkins pointed out in his galactic alignment book on, you know, the 2012 stuff is that in proton precession, the proton precession is equivalent to the proton's distance from hadron's distance from the center of the nucleus that it's part of. And that sort of ties in with us. But then it also seems to be tied in with the galactic core eruptions as well. To think, well, how come all this stuff's keyed if we're just in some insignificant little corner of the galaxy? How come all these resonances are totally tied in? But are you familiar with Halton Arp's work in, you know, divergent redshift?
I mean, I've read his book and read a couple of his papers. David, I don't know if you have or not.
No, I'm not familiar.
But yeah, I mean, it's good, and he was ostracized for a long time. But yeah, he was a really credible astronomer, and the last, I don't know, 30 years of his career was all battling over what he was finding, because he was turning up a lot of the evidence for these anomalous redshifts and these anomalous quasar phenomenon. But he had a different interpretation of them, that, yeah, the galaxies were giving birth to new galaxies, whereas other people in the mainstream cosmology just say, well, those are just neighboring galaxies or galaxies that are actually quite far away from each other but look like they're side by side because of what's called gravitational lensing and other distortion events of space-time that create an illusion. So that is his basic premise, that, yeah, actually the universe is a self-generative thing. And that adds into other theories like Fred Hoyle or Paul LaViolette and static universe theories and so on. So his is a piece of that puzzle. And he just recently passed away, I think. But he was
did late last year.
He was important to that paradigm and his ideas, I think, especially about like jets. He actually talks about superluminal jets in galactic creation. And I thought that was really interesting, just touched on theory a little bit. But he was mostly an experimentalist, yeah.
Yeah. Well, that's the thing is, that, right, they have two galaxies that are connected, and you know, one will have like a redshift of 17,500 kilometers per second, and you know, in the other galaxy will be like 35,000 like kilometers per second. And of course, they actually moved in quantized stages too. That was another thing. Before I really had the whole picture, I was looking at quantized galaxies. That, you know, these redshifts, they aren't like in a like a steady curve or anything like that. It's like they're all in certain like energetic states. So that's what the higher redshift actually denotes, the younger age of the galaxy as it's forming. So they're not 13 billion light years away or anything. They're in our local group. And the redshift concept has given us a model of the universe in what we call Euclidean space, which actually doesn't exist. You know, so all that mapping. So who knows how the thing's really put together? I still cogitate on this stuff regularly. I try to keep up on the latest Electric Universe lectures, and I wish there was enough time in the day, and this was all I had to do. You know, I've got a life. I got to stay alive. I got a lot of other things happening in life, but I really want to know this stuff. I want to know how the universe is put together. You know, I seek cosmic orientation of my soul. I think we all do. We sort of get comfortable within our belief systems at some point, but for me, I'm still restless, even though I've kind of got my four world theory and my approach to the mandala, which I feel quite satisfied as far as my inner landscape. There's still so much I don't know.
So there's something I really have been eager to bring to the table, and I kind of, it was something when we first started the conversation, you actually brought up poltergeist. And I've had this whole thing with poltergeist. Like, seriously, like I just finished a project where I took, so, you know, E.T. and Poltergeist came out within a month of each other. And it was a summer of Spielberg, because, you know, Tobe Hooper directed Poltergeist, but Steven Spielberg might as well have, because he was there the whole time overseeing the whole project, and while he's working on E.T. But there's this thing that I noticed, and this is how my mind works, was that E.T. and Poltergeist are actually the exact same length of time. The films themselves, the running times of the films, are the same. And so I decided as a project to take the two films and overlay them with 50-50 transparency. And there's a number of things that show up that are just, like, phenomenal. I'll send it your way. You can check it out. And
Please.
I play music over it, a band called Mogwai, and they came out with an album called Mr. Beast, and they came out with an album, The Hawk is Howling. And this is the whole thing with Poltergeist, is to say, to her, it's just another child, but it's just a small child, but to us, it is the Beast. And so they're acknowledging that it's the Beast. And then the sound that they use for the Beast when it shows up in the film is actually ended up being the sound of the MGM lion for years afterwards, that Industrial Light Magic made the sound for the scene when it emerges, you know, out of a doorway. And it's like this thing. And then they just use that. And so it's like MGM trademark. It's the fucking Beast. You know, you got Dark Side of the Rainbow. And then in Poltergeist, the father says, oh, what side of the rainbow are we on now? You know, in referring to the woman who's a little person. I want to be politically correct here. But anyways, there's some certain phenomenons that show up. One of them in particular is the thing that E.T. has his glowing heart, you know. And in the film Poltergeist, when they're referring to the closet, they say, that is the heart of the house. And then they make a comment that this house has many hearts. And if you look around the space in Poltergeist, you'll see hearts everywhere. Heart balloons, hearts on the wall, hearts, hearts, hearts. And there's a scene where the mother is running down a hallway, and the hallway, like, extends like a telescope, and she's running towards this glowing door. Well, when on the other side of the door, you know, the closet at this point has formed into this, like, glowing red tunnel. I think they actually made it with fiberglass or whatever. As she's running, when you overlay them, it's actually the scene where E.T. at the end is like, it focuses on his heart and he points to his heart, and she's like running towards the heart of the house. And so it's the symbolism is very blatant. You know, you can see the significance of it. But the reason, more than just how trippy this is, the reason why I'm bringing it up is there's this idea, and it's so obvious, it's in plain sight, you know, is that extraterrestrials over and over again, when anyone goes into Kabbalah and like that, the Klippot are literally aliens. I mean, that's how they're it translates as shells, but they relate it to alien intelligences. Even in the Zohar, it's like the implication. And so when you're looking at what people call demons or people call angels or whatnot, it's like it's these people relate to it like that they're the exact same thing. And that's what seems to be being communicated with E.T. and Poltergeist. It's this kind of a Kabbalistic joke. He's very Jewish, Steven Spielberg. I actually feel that he's included in all of his films a degree of Kabbalah, even with Jaws. That's a whole other thing I could get into, and I've gotten into on the show before because I find it really interesting. There's a split atom, and I mean, that's the whole thing in Jaws, is that he's on his way to, he had delivered the bomb, which got dropped on Hiroshima in Poltergeist, in Jaws. The guy who, you know, they go to help them kill the shark, you know, and he's got all these jaws. But then he's talking about people getting split in half, and then he gets cut in half. He split the atom. It's like the split of Dom, you know, so it's a symbolic thing, you know. I mean, it's kind of far out, but I'll totally go there with it. But, it's just, there's this phenomenon of ETs and as extraterrestrials and interdimensional intelligences that have been communicated in mysticism being one and the same. And the script, or the screenplay, that both of these films came out of was called Night Skies. And in there, you know, so I had been watching these two films and tripping out on the dog. They have this golden retriever in both films, and that it seems to be communicating something about Sirius. And I was just going on my own kind of tangent with this, and I was speculating. But then if you read that screenplay, in referring to the aliens, there's a small boy who goes, they're from the Dog Star. They're from Sirius. He says this in the script, you know? And so I'm just like, and it comes up again later in the script. He's like, Sirius. And so I'm like, oh, it's definitely communicating something about this whole point. Like, it's not an accident, you know, as far as I can tell.
Right. Well, I've wondered, you know, because I know there's things in movies and is, you know, well, I've got friends that are totally into Pirates of the Caribbean. I think that that's the whole key to, like, solving the mysteries of the corrupt system here. And, yes, a friend of mine has actually done some writing on it. And there's a lot to it, right? Port Royal's like New Zealand. And, like, the because you got, like, the East India Company here is actually the government and stuff. There's a lot to it. But whether or not, like, so one friend of mine is into a lot of stuff. He goes, yeah, where's the other witness? He says, great story. He goes, I'm not going to relate to the system until I get another witness. But did they do this intentionally, or is it somehow synchronistically happening as part of our deeper unconsciousness? I don't know, but it's fascinating. I'm fascinated by what you're saying there. I love that line of thought. Because I think I spoke with John when we spoke previously. We're talking about movies as sort of, and this was my friend Gordon Israel, that's his sort of thesis, is that the powers that be, they're honor bound to tell us what's going on, but they can't really explain it because it's not just the machinations of their sort of like flunkies in government pulling their stunts, but there's a sort of a spiritual / mythological component that can only be sort of brought forward in things like movies. So that's why he believes that they're actually putting all these things in movies, because like Pirates of the Caribbean, at the time, most expensive movie ever made, supposedly based on a ride at Disneyland. But there's all these like amazing key, like, you know, in the first one, right, because a lot of guys are skeletons, right? And, you know, they got to put their gold coin back in, right? We'll see, because everybody's in bankruptcy, right, after like the 33 bankruptcy and all that, and gold will be moved. So in order to kind of come back in, you've got to have substance and put gold in. I actually tried that. I had a long battle with the tax goons here, as I call them, the IRD. And I actually filed my papers in response in Admiralty, and I tried paying a gold coin into the thing based on this. Man, it's like somebody, you know, I don't want to be impolite, but sort of like somebody put a hot pepper up the ass of the judge, right? It's like, but you don't bring that stuff up in court unless they actually threw me out, which was fine. It's better than getting locked up. But I'm coming out of bankruptcy. Here, I'm putting some substance in. Here's my gold coin to do it. So we've looked at this, but the reason I brought it up was one of the things I think I mentioned in a previous conversation was about the 1956 movie Forbidden Planet.
Yes.
Do you remember that?
Oh, of course.
Now, that one there, and most Francis. Expensive movie kind of made to that time, very high tech for 1956.
Sure.
Basically, what is the whole thing, right? They land on that the planet of the Krell. I can't remember the name of the planet, but they Altair, I think that was it. And they right, they start encountering that invisible thing that the monster gets worse and worse and it's killing them, right? And they put up the electric shield, and it's like big monster's getting stronger and stronger. And it turns out that, well, the whole planet is like this one big giant free energy machine that can create anything that you can imagine. So these people built it to create a utopia, but instead, like, their fears and things took over, and the entire planet was devastated except for the machinery inside. So this monster that was attacking them was like monster from the id, as they were calling it in the movie.
They call it that in the film. They say the monster from the id.
Monster from the id. Yeah, wow. You get that movie and watch it.
It's been a while. And I mean, I've seen it, but yeah, it's.
I believe that's it. So this modern system we got, right, where the courts are backwards, we got backwards money, we got, you know, the low astral like electricity being pumped down wires instead of the high end being transmitted sort of longitudinally. the system is the monster from our id. You know, look back on through the history of all these like alternative sort of documentaries that came out. You know, like when Zeitgeist first came out, I kind of liked it to a certain extent, but I felt that they tried to use the information in the wrong way. You know, like trying showing astrotheology, but making it look like people were merely anthropomorphizing it. And there was sort of like no solutions, but it was still cool. But then you had guys like Ben Stewart came out with like Esoteric Agenda and Chimatica. And I'm thinking, you know, he's talking about going, yeah, like the conspiracy is real, you know, like Bush family and their ancestors, they've been meddling in the Middle East for 1,000 years.
Right.
But yeah, you can't wake up the world. And it gets into like the phantom DNA experiment, cymatics, you know, as like sort of keys of understanding. The only person you can wake up is yourself. And then, you know, show by the example of yourself, and that's how things are going to spread out. Yeah, in that sense, you know, you look at that forbidden planet, you know, sure, the system that does exist, it is all of us in our collective irresponsibility. You know, certain ones of us are waking up in certain ways and trying to figure it out. And of course, I don't know if you guys have looked at it, probably have seen it because you can't help these days. There's been all these different movements all over, you know, sovereign citizens, free men, this and that. I mean, I've seen that stuff for the last 3 decades and all its various permutations, copyrighting your name and trying to put in bills and all that. What boils down to is really all people are looking for is their right of self-determination within it. But if you don't have proper orientation, the system's there sort of to stop us. And the system goes back, you know, the beginning of like the King James Bible, the East India Company. This whole system is basically here to kind of force us to wake up. As Riley Crabb said, you know, people, so-called conspirators, the powers that be behind the system, he said, they're serving the light by opposing it. He says, you have to pray for these people, pray for their healing, he says, because they've given up their spiritual lives, their eternal spiritual lives for temporal power.
Right.
That's like the whole thing behind the, in fact, even get into like the black nobility, the Guelphs and stuff, that's sort of been like the family philosophy for like, you know, 1,000 years is get it all now because there is nothing afterwards. And that's in the skull and bones. That's the whole concept behind the skull and bones is when you're gone, it's just skull and bones. You know, you do this stuff while you're here. You get everything you can. And they've used this over the centuries to gain like absolute temporal control as well as psychological control over our minds, which kind of eventuates into the spiritual control of the destiny of life wave of the planet. So now we're at this point of time where everybody's sort of waking up. And all these sort of like wild different ideas are coming around. But nonetheless, I'm just kind of rambling on. But yeah, I agree. There's really something to the movies. And you've mentioned 2001. I never thought of that as the four worlds of Kabbalah. I'm going to have to go rewatch it in that light.
Yeah, there's some interesting phenomenon with 2001 with the flipping of the screen. I don't know if you've heard of this. There's a guy, I wish I could remember his name. We've had him on the show.
Jay Reichner?
No, but that is another interesting case. But this guy does... He did a thing of 2001, A False Flag Odyssey, where he basically discovered that, as a matter of fact, Kubrick, in 2001, there's specific scenes that are actually flipped. They're backwards. And there's certain only ways that you can tell the hose on the spacesuits will actually flip to the other side. When it's showing the people who are being frozen that they'll be on one side and then they'll be on the other. And if you look at the different frames, you can see that he's changed it around. This gets really interesting if you look at it like you're ascending the tree of life, because that's the whole deal, is that you have these polarities that exist. But then also that's the meaning of the cleat boat, is that they're literally the tetragrammaton in reverse. And so it gets really interesting in that sense, you know, because you're
Let me interrupt real quick. So that's actually Matt Pulver, and he runs Blue Science. Tom, I'll have to send you that website because I actually write some articles with him too. But he's a really interesting guy.
Yeah, I'm very interested.
Yeah, he does a lot of ether science work, but he also does some, obviously, like Sync 2001 work too. Anyway, okay, I got to get going. So you guys, you know, go on as long as Tom, you're able, and David, that you're able. And I'm looking forward to listening to the rest of it. But I'm sorry, I have to go to work, unfortunately.
That's fine.
So thanks again, Tom, for getting up so early and talking with us and talking with me specifically, because I know you're going to stay on a little bit longer. And so I'll be in touch again sooner than later.
Oh, great. No, anytime, John. It's fun to chat. All right. You take care.
Okay.
Thanks.
All right. Take care, Tom. All right. See you, David.
All right, man.
All right, cool.
So, Tom, just really quickly, we probably won't go on too much longer, but I'll tell you what, man, I am enjoying this so much. And I know last week, or the week before, it didn't work out, and I know I'm not trying to put you through anything. I'd be very interested in having you on again in the not too distant future, if you'd be willing. You might not need to get up so early. Maybe we can arrange a time that might be easier for you. That shouldn't be a problem for us. Maybe even a different day if necessary, depending on John's schedule.
And also another idea, too, that I'm doing with my friend Tech in New York. We're doing Google Hangouts. We've switched from Skype to Google Hangouts. It's a much better technology. We did okay today, but even last night, I mean, I seemed to have a bit of trouble with John's connection. But even, like, I was talking to a friend of mine in the South Island last night on Skype. Sometimes Skype is just crap. And it's working fine here. I mean, you're coming through crystal clear, so there's no problem with that.
Right.
But I am fascinated. I mean, I've really looked through Jay Widener's stuff. It's quite interesting on, you know, his whole take that, you know, 2001 was like it's all alchemical sort of journey, and the screen and the obelisk was actually the screen.
Yes. Yeah. The monolith is actually the dimension of the screen itself turned in another direction. And so you can see indicators throughout the whole film where it's like everyone's like, turn the monolith sideways. You know, it's implied in subliminal ways that aren't so subliminal once you know that. And that's that relates to, so the thing is with Poltergeist and E.T., just to get back to that, is that that's a direct nod to Kubrick, and it's very overt. That's why E.T. ends with Thus Begs Zarathustra. You know, I mean, he put the drum sound in there when the rainbow appears across the sky. It's a direct, admitted Kubrick reference. But then if you watch Poltergeist, you'll notice that the spirit that comes out of the television, if you look at the television, when that happens, it says 237. So you have room 237, 2 times 3 times 7 is 42. You know, Danny in The Shining has his 42 shirt. He's watching Summer of 42, which is a sync reference to Pink Floyd, as far as I can tell, with Summer of 42. It goes in sync incredibly with Adam Hart Mother. And it's this phenomenon. So as far as I can tell, it's a total sync wink. It's like, you know, that's like one of the most classic syncs I've ever come across is actually that film and that album. And so, and that would make sense. You see Adam Hart Mother shows up in the Chelsea record store in A Clockwork Orange, right there with the 2001 soundtrack, and as Ode to Joy is playing, and all these kind of things. You know, they just start to add up. So, yeah, I feel there's definitely some major connections that exist there. Also, noticing that if you watch The Shining, you know, that's the whole premise of the film, is that this is built on an Indian burial ground. And they emphasize that point, you know, and they're like, we had to fend off several Indian attacks. And then you have in Poltergeist, they build the house on a graveyard and they didn't move the bodies. It's like, you didn't move the bodies, but you moved the headstones, didn't you? You know, it's like Coach Fox, Coach, you know, it's like,
It's been 20 something years since I've watched that movie. I'll have to watch it to get the detail, but I'd like to see your overlay.
Sure. Yeah.
That sounds awesome.
I'll send it your way. Absolutely. Are you on the goddamn Facebook, or should I send it to your email?
Yeah, no, I'm on Facebook or email either way.
Okay.
Yeah, link. Great. Yeah, Thomas Joseph Brown on Facebook.
Okay.
So
you got it.
Which I was going to quit, and I know it's a spy book and they're experimenting, but I've met a lot. I've got like 4,000 friends, and I actually interact with a lot of them. You know, I've got friends that, you know, I actually chat with in Portuguese and Spanish, and I just use like Google Translate and just like whatever. It's like really cool. So that's high end. They spy on me anyway, so who cares?
Yeah, you might watch me, but you know, I watch you too. We're watching each other. Look at us. You know, there's no glass houses. You know, there's only glass houses. I don't know.
Exactly. And this stuff is totally compromised anyway. You know, I mean, the thing. So who cares? I just figured, just tell the truth in public. You know, then you don't have to worry about anything.
Yeah.
And that's the thing. It's true. They're monitoring people, looking for people who are waking up and doing stuff. But now everybody is like, hell with these guys. Just stand up and do it.
Yeah.
You know, so we've got the right to self-determination. And that's it, because you look at these freeman movements and things, and what's a freeman? You know, a free man, which is two words. The original Magna Carta had free man, but then there was another version, because that was 1215 or whatever, and then 1295, I'm not sure if I got the dates right. That changes to freeman, which is single word. Freeman is like the highest order of slave. Still tied into the feudal lord, right? You can own property and fee simple, and you can come and go, but you know, if you don't pay your still dues at a certain level, you still get your ass kicked. So the freeman movement is part of the deception, because it's just the highest order of slave, but you're still a slave. You still don't have your full right of self-determination within that. See, in that sense, New Zealand's actually quite interesting place, because this place wasn't taken by conquest or like Australia, where they claimed there was nobody there, even though the native people were there for like 50,000 years. But New Zealand, everything was done honorably through treaty. And even though the crown over time dishonored the treaty and did it, nonetheless, the stuff still has standing here. So this is like one place in the world that can actually like come back out. There's quite a bit going on behind the scenes here, which I think is soon to pop out.
Yeah, I mean, my family moved to New Zealand when, okay, so my great-grandfather lived in Russia, and he immigrated to the U.S., and he was on the East Coast, I guess, and he was in a silverware company where he, at one point, and I don't know what the circumstances of his life were completely, but I know that he was struggling, and he decided to go from door to door of people who were paying off their silverware, as real silverware, right? And he told them that the business was going under, when in fact it was not. And he told them that if they gave him such and such an amount, they could call it even. He collected from everybody who was paying off their silverware, and then he took the money that he got from them and left to New Zealand and changed his last name and had his family in New Zealand. And so, you know, that my mother doesn't know her actual last name and was never told by her father, because even though he knew, because it was like, you know, they just wanted to just. That world is done. We've moved on. And so, yeah, I come from a criminal background. He was actually a rabbi, right. My great-grandfather, who did this.
Right. So. Family histories can be funny, eh?
Yeah, no, I didn't find all that out until recently. I actually kind of put my mom on the spot. It was just like, just tell me the story. And I actually wrote some of it down, just, you know, and also my grandfather following that had some sketchy aspects to him. He's a smuggler. During the war, so yeah,
well, that's just business during wartime. I mean, the war itself is criminal, so you got to survive.
Absolutely, yeah. What he did was far less criminal than what people who are not referred to as criminals were actually up to. So that's not to rationalize too much, but I definitely agree with you there. I feel there's something to be said for how the criminal atrocities that go on in the name of whatever that you know. Are kind of written off because they're for God and country, you know.
Exactly. And ongoing today, you know, the earth needs a big change. And this is the thing is there is big change going on in the solar system all the way back to the galactic center, this big energetic event. If you go on YouTube and search for Sagittarius A star, it's actually A with an asterisk.
Well, it's Ophiuchus, right?
From that sense, yeah, but Sagittarius A star is considered to be supermassive black hole.
Right.
But since I don't believe in black holes, it's some sort of plasma pinch at the center of the, you know, dielectric plates, which are forming, you know, the stars and the galactic formation. But nonetheless, there's a big energetic event happening right now up there. There's sort of videos on there like Big Meal coming up for Black Hole, which is put out by, name escapes me, over in Germany, the one that Halt and Arp went to work for. But nonetheless, there's something happening up there right now. And if this is the beginning of a, potential, you know, the galactic core eruption, which we're about due, according to Paul LaViolette's, you know, that seems to be the time when there's the big changes over. And our whole solar system's changing. You know, Jupiter's changing, new radio frequencies are coming out of it. Venus has slowed down and the atmosphere's sped up and it's gotten brighter. You know, Mars is definitely warming up. You know, we know that the, what you can call it, climate change here, whatever you want to call it here, but, you know, definitely. We've had a gale blowing here for 4 days. It's finally sort of stopped a little bit, but that might just be a break, which really isn't normal. I mean, the stuff's obviously, you know, the cyclones, hurricanes are moving, you know, the latitudes are changing and where they're going. Obviously, you know, people can say, well, you know, because we're using polluting stuff, so we better like tax people more. It's like, the thing is, the whole solar system's changing. What's ever happening in the galactic center, it seems like the wavefront started hitting about 50 years ago, and it's just getting more intense now. And the scientists are looking at it. So you have a look. There's quite a bit going on with that. So we're at the point now is just kind of like just stand up and tell the truth no matter what.
Right.
Because whatever the big change is going to come through, it's all about spiritual orientation. And that's what the system basically distracts people away. So things like the Kabbalah, it's all about orientation. How do you orient yourself to these cosmic archetypes? And that's why to me, the you know, that's why I say I did this like basically 31 years ago. I did this Kabbalah, say Hollow Earth Kabbalah. I don't have it on this computer. I'll find it and you know, we'll keep in touch. I'll send you the, I think you'll like it because you've got the background understanding that. But I tried to me, it all had to be real. It wasn't just something that was up in, you know, in some imaginary realm.
Right.
I believe if this is the real thing, if this is the real underlying structure, then it's got to manifest in the very nature of things, the very nature of nature and growing things. And that's why I like Goethe's method, because I've got these books like Phenomenology of the Etheric, which sort of bring you through sort of like Goethe's Metamorphoses of Plants. So you start seeing, you know, things aren't linear. There's like this higher order sort of function weaving things from, which can't always be explained in a simple fashion. It's sort of more like you have to go out and cogitate on it and put it into your mind.
Yeah, totally. And, yeah, there's something to be said for the template that exists on its own. And the there's a line, and it's a very thin line, between what is synchronistically unfolding on its own that is a higher order, and what is mimicking that order or artistically conveying that order, especially when you get into different types of multimedia where you can see these people are consciously pushing different archetypes and different kind of correspondences, where you can see that it's blatant examples of where they know what they're doing, and they're either communicating it artistically or they're actually trying to do something. I don't really know completely what they're trying to do, but it's really fascinating that you can't take this ultimate position a lot of the time and know what's happening on its own and what people are doing kind of in terms of their self-expression. And so I'm always fascinated by that, because when I'm dealing with synchronicity and I get into something like I just gave you one example of many examples where I take these two films and I transpose them together, it's like there's these things that show up where I'm like, wow, that seems so uncanny. It's like, how could that happen on its own? It could have happened on its own. It could just be as simple as that. But at the same time, I don't really know, because I'm not in communication with the person and he hasn't told me. You know, I didn't call up Steven Spielberg and tell him what I found and then have him say, oh yeah, totally, I meant for E.T. to point at his heart right when she's running towards the heart of the house. You know, it's like, I don't really know.
Right, right. Well, that's, well, I mentioned earlier, Vincent Gaddis, you know, a guy who coined the term Bermuda Triangle. You know, Vince was brilliant, researched a lot of stuff, you know, and like he had the police reporter background. So, you know, just the facts, you know, the old Joe Fry, just the facts, ma'am, uh-huh. If they are far out. And I asked Vince one day, we were just sitting around chatting. I said, Vince, I said, if you, before you die, because I mean, when I met him, he was basically had arthritis. He was going blind. He was struggling. Like I said, we took care of him for like 7-8 years, just like much revered uncle. But I said, if there's one thing, if you had the answer to one thing, all the stuff you've researched, if there's one thing that you could actually find out before you die, what would it be? And without even really like hesitating, he goes, well, there's two things. He goes, one is Oak Island. He goes, I want to know what's buried on Oak Island. Yeah, that's it. One of Nova Scotia.
Yeah.
With a, he's going, he goes,
I mean, they
he goes, I want to know that.
I'm sorry. I'm trying to make sure that it's the one that I know of where they dug and then it just kept on going and going and going and going and they don't know what the fuck. Yeah.
They can't get down there because there's like these side tunnels filled with gravel. And it's like, how'd they even do that stuff?
Totally.
It's like, yeah, yeah, there was that. Right. He goes, but that's sort of an. You want to know that from the mystery of things. But he said, really, the one thing, if you know, he says, if you could understand the mystery of synchronicity.
Yeah.
He said, because that rises. He said, when you consider synchronicity, and he studied a lot of that stuff, I mean, because Vince was always interested in all these things. And he's saying that rises you above the whole physical concept. He said, there's obviously some sort of higher order thing happening. It's almost like, you know, wheels within wheels, and at certain points they connect and all these things happen. But anyway, I thought that was fascinating. That was, you know, it was a great researcher. You know, that's the one thing he wanted to know, you know, because that was the biggest puzzle of his life.
That's it. And that's the whole premise of this show. I mean, that's the one commonality that everyone we have on, that's the focus of synchronicity. And it's funny because that's a term coined by Carl Jung, but that is nothing new. You study theosophy, you know that's everything. Like, you get into morals and dogma, like Albert Pike's whole deal, you get into any of these mysticisms, whether contemporary or not, that's the basis, is that they have correspondences. What can you extrapolate from those correspondences? Correlation doesn't equal causation, but at the same time, what can you understand through this? So, yeah, no, that's everything, absolutely. I mean, there is no mysticism without synchronicity, and it's always been that way. I mean, even if you get into, like, what gematria is in the first place, it's like, it's the basis of our whole language has to do with correspondences. This word corresponds to this word because of a gematrical numeration, and then what can you extrapolate from how those relate to each other? You know, a lot of times with Hebrew and Semitic languages, you'll notice that there will be words that have the same gematrical value or they're used in, that like where a word will have two meanings and that you'll happen, those words happen to be opposites, like totally, like I'm totally fascinated by that.
Absolutely. Yeah, that's right. Yeah, well, that was how I got into correspondence with Kenneth Grant, was over gematria, and probably corresponded with him for probably about 5 or 6 years. You know, quite a lot of letters. Unfortunately, yeah, all those letters got they were in file boxes out in California, and rats got in them and sort of destroyed those and a lot of other files. Unfortunately, so I wish I still had my old Kenneth Grant correspondence, just because it was kind of cool.
Yeah,
guys like that. But I say one of the but I'm actually mentioned in some of his books. You know, some of my ideas, not to depth. It was almost like he was kind of holding me off to a bit, because I think some of the stuff I was coming up with was a bit too. I came up with this Kabbalistic formula of a tau, elif tau, tau, elif yod mem, which actually I started getting these dream transmissions. This is a story I've never really told much, but I don't really care. I've actually been thinking about coming out, because I ran this guy, Michael Berdio, who was actually mentioned in Kenneth Grant's books. He was in Chicago, and I had known he was around. I had heard of him, you know, the Ordo Templi Orientis Antiqua, and you know, the Karanzin Club, and all these. He was connected in with all these weird things. This occult artist guy, I suppose he had this zotheriometer, and you could tune in like alien radio waves and all that, which always seemed a bit of fanciful stuff. Because I actually met Michael and sort of like hung out with him for a few years. Is you know, we catch up like once a week and have like discussions on things, just like we're chatting here. In fact, it was Michael that put me in touch with Kenneth Grant. He goes, oh, now you've got to check with him. But when I first met Michael, the first night I sort of met him and started chatting to him, I had this dream where some sort of entity came and did this sort of like 16-pointed ritual dance around me. And each sort of point of the 16 things was sort of like, you know, kung fu sort of animal form, but it's sort of like, and it was also the outline of it. There would be like a fundamental archetypal form to it, but then it would move around. It'd be like a letter and a certain stream of knowledge and all that. But there were 16 of them. And I started having a series of dreams like that. And I felt it was like this angel. And I was trying to think, well, what's the angel? And the name kept, you know, in meditation, it kept coming to me, Adam. So I called it the atomic angel, right? It was just sort of a thing. And I was thinking, so I had this dictionary of angels. So I looked it up and I'm thinking, I wonder if there actually is an angel with that name. And it came up at Tom. Mm-hmm. Elif Tau Tau Elif Yod Mem, which is the angel that that revealed the universe of darkness and light to Mani of the Manichaeists, right? That was, but then I realized it was actually a Kabbalistic formula, right? Elif Tau Tau Elif, right? That's the two sides of weaving things together, and that was what this paper I did back in '83. I called it the Kabbalah Vat Taum. It was my sort of explanation. That's why I had like the Kabbalah on the outside of the planet. You know, the cliff out on the inside is the shell being the planet, right? The shell.
Right.
So just reflected thing. And, yeah, it was quite fascinating because it fit all the Kabbalistic codes and stuff. But it was funny because I kind of fell out with Berdio because he's sort of in this fanciful sort of realm. It was interesting, but he was more of a cult artist believer. He was a fun guy to chat with, quite an intellect. And Grant, too. I mean, once I got into Steiner stuff and all that, and I just looked at that stuff, I thought, you know, so, well-sculpted cul-de-sac, but I found there was no vitality in there for me. I was just fascinated by the gematria and the interconnections and different
sure.
things.
Yeah, that weaving principle shows up a lot with my studies with my rabbi, and I've applied it in a few places that are really, in my opinion, mind-blowing. One of them is if you take Jim Morrison's An American Prayer, which I found his original manuscript, printout of it, where he actually, every section of it, he draws a little line, and there's line, line, line all the way through, and there's sections, like he divided up his poetry, and I happened to notice that the amount of sections corresponded to the first section of Aleister Crowley's Book of the Law, and that if you actually go every other line, you jump in, and then you interweave the two texts, they actually work as like a psychedelic conversation, and there's portions of it that are just really, really unbelievable. So I called it Libra Lacerda Rex and got, you know, I had a kind of a kick out of it, but then there was further implications because I didn't put together initially this whole deal where, you know, Jim Morrison, one of his last albums, his only compilation album that he gave the go-ahead for was called 13, and it had 13 tracks. And if you flip the album over, you see Jim Morrison with his hands folded over a stone bust of Aleister Crowley. And so that was like shortly before he died. He's like, it's like, what? You're like representing Thelema or whatever, but I could see that you could take it that the Book of the Law is actually literally claiming to be just what it says, which is the law of the new eon, whereas an American Prayer actually has a degree of intention, is actually like not a rebuttal, but kind of like another side to how to approach the new eon in terms of like intentionality, that there's actually a degree of intention to do with it rather than being like enforcing that this is the law, you know, but like this is a sincere prayer of, you know, what we're doing here. Like, what are we doing? Why are we doing it? Rather than like, this is what need kind of this more.
Right.
Yeah. You get the idea.
Right. If you come across the guys, I'm trying to think of his last name, Dave, he's just come out with his book, Weird Scenes Inside the Canyon. And he did that whole series. It was actually on the web. He wrote over the years on.
I've read some of it. Yeah. His whole thing.
The whole thing with
military families and all this stuff. Yeah.
Yeah. Like Jim Morrison's dad was the guy that faked the Gulf of Tonkin incident and started the Vietnamese War.
Right.
And so basically, you know, Dave, one of the things he showed, he had a picture of Jim on the bridge of the, whatever ship it was, the Nimitz. I can't remember, with taking a picture with his admiral dad. And the admiral steams off for Vietnam to start the war, and Jim shows up in Laurel Canyon with like five albums of material already written, and none of those guys could play. They had to learn how to play. A lot of those early albums for all these different bands, the Birds and all that, they were all like the Wrecking Crew, which was like Glenn Campbell and all these other cats. They played on them while these other guys learned how to play.
Right.
So there's a lot. I don't think Jim Morrison actually died. That whole thing, nobody ever saw his body. Even his girlfriend didn't see his body. Suppose the whole thing was all real.
Actually, you know, 2 years ago or thereabouts, there was a club owner in Paris who actually came forward in like his 80s or something, who claims that they actually found his body in a bathroom stall in his club, and that they basically everyone who witnessed it swore to secrecy, you know, he claims to have moved the body out, brought it to the apartment, but then the only two people saw his body. There was no autopsy. It went directly, I mean, it was like boom, boom, he's buried, you know. But the argument still is not that necessarily just that he died of an overdose, but that it's really easy to kill somebody if you're giving them something that they're injecting into them. And then if there's no autopsy, how are you supposed to know what was actually injected? You know, and that they could easily
have
taken him out. But it's still speculation. It's all speculation. But I did find it interesting that this guy was just like, you know what, at this point, I got nothing to lose. And you can read about that if you're interested. It seemed pretty legit as far as I can tell. And it makes a lot more sense in the official story, you know.
It could be. Well, I came, I think it was, might have been Jim Keith or guy Ken that did Steam Shovel Press. Somewhere I read years ago that apparently like 10 years after Morrison supposedly died, his passport was still listed as active. I wasn't sure how they checked that, but I did come across that stuff. Whether he did or didn't, the interesting thing was is that he was certainly came out of a very deep military intelligence family.
Oh, yeah. A lot of those guys from Laurel Canyon, and that's a very interesting phenomenon. Absolutely. Yeah. But then you have Tavistock, and you have, like, the LSD that's being distributed. It's actually got, you know, I mean, you got, like, what's his name? One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest. Jeez, I'm spacing. The guy, Ken Kesey,
right?
You know, I mean, you can hear his recordings with MK Ultra. You know, like, I mean, it's available. Like, it's really weird to hear him like talking about that the recorder looks like some kind of lizard or something, and he's tripping out. You know, but it's like that's real. Like, he's at Stanford, you know, participating in this whole thing, and then he's the guy who's doing these huge acid tests. Where is he getting the acid? But from Tavistock. And so you're just like, well, okay, so when the LSD changed, and then he's like, no more acid tests, the whole thing feels very orchestrated to me. I feel like there's a stronger argument for that being orchestrated than for it not being, in terms of like, that they're doing this experiment, and then they're like, okay, well, end it. You know, we've seen what the results are, and you got people like Abbie Hoffman sticking fucking flowers into guns around the Pentagon, and I do not believe that Abbie Hoffman worked for the CIA. I have a hard time buying that, you know.
It's hard. It's hard to say. Yeah, I mean, he was a bit of a mix. But see, what was happening, it was basically what I think they thought was going to happen is it was all about, because supposedly the Illuminati thing was a disruption of culture and the breaking down of things. And in that sense, you know, rock and roll and drugs did actually work, and they did seem to kind of go hand in hand. But a friend of mine said, because it got bigger than them.
Yeah.
Right? Because music is deep. Right? Kind of got out of control in a sense, right? Because things are changing. And I saw that in the early sort of 70s. people started experimenting with acid, and everybody's like, I was a teenager, right? And we're all talking about Tibetan Book of the Dead. You know, I'd been through like Leary stuff and, you know, the Eight Circuits and looking at John Lilly's work and, you know, looking at all, you know, Evans Wentz's Tibetan translations and trying to figure stuff out. Then all of a sudden, everybody's doing like heroin and Quaaludes and dropping dead. And I mean, I never did any of that stuff. But it was almost like this big wave came in like a blanket to snuff out.
Yeah, and the acid itself changed. And so you have STP all of a sudden with Altamont, and it's like they're not on what they were on before, and they're acting like they're presenting it like it's the same thing. And then it's like, well, look at the results. Like, you can tell a thing by its fruits, like what the nature of the thing is, you know? And the fact that that came out of Tavistock just feels very suspicious to me. It's like, that seems very, like, that's kind of a strategic move on their part. You darken the whole deal. But if you take in LSD-25, like Osley acid, and then you look at Altamont, you're like, they're not taking the stuff that doesn't give you any sense of the chemical. They're having a very chemical experience where you're feeling like you're having, like, brain bubbles, you know? It's like, that's not a pleasant thing. Like, why is the whole front row crying, you know? It's like, and it just,
oh, exactly, you know. Yeah. There's a lot of mind control. But the interesting thing is the same forces were behind the Cultural Revolution in China. But since it was much more ideologically driven in a sense, they didn't need the drugs over there. Right? They just sort of...
Right.
But then, it all happened at the same time.
Totally. And then you got like Artie Lang and stuff in the UK. You're probably familiar. He did not. He's like, you know, basically looking at, what do they call it? War games where you're taking kind of like these mathematical cause and effect deals where it's like things will actually go in a loop and they pretend like they're not a loop. You know, it's like he would apply the same principles that they'd apply to issues with warring nations and apply it to the family unit and see how you can have an unreconcilable loop occurring. If it's going to continue on its own terms, it has a certain inertia. And if there's no outside force stepping in, it's just going to basically destroy itself. And that the people's families are basically playing these out. It's like, is this just something that we're doing because of our own neuroses, or is this something that's actually being conditioned upon us to play out as a method of control? It's a good question. I don't really know the answer. I mean, I.
Well, the thing is, David, for me, it's like I'm no longer looking for an answer. I'm just trying to better phrase the question.
Good.
You know, because there is a mystery to things. Yeah, that's what I realized, you know, when I sit there and meditate on my four worlds. And see, to me, I'm generally not on that third rock from the sun. You know, I try to stay in the center of the mandala, but that's actually very difficult. So usually I'm in the formative world, which is the anthropocentric. That's the one I feel most closely in my sensations and everything. So I really have to kind of go into the meditations to pull myself up into the higher sort of thing. But nonetheless, is ultimately... And of course, this all totally ties in. You know, I found the relationship between the Kabbalah and the Tibetan Book of the Dead, and the Egyptian Book of the Dead, right? Because, you know, we're grounded here. This is our initiatory process in the grounding. But at some point, obviously, we shed these like animated sort of meat puppets, and we've got to deal with the forces in their true sense, in their ungrounded state. And that's what the Bardo Thodol is about keeping this orientation no matter what, you know, in the face of, you know, because things don't appear properly. You know, it's all about the colors and lights, you know, that you see in the, which is basically the mandala in its different, got peaceful and wrathful forms, which is the heart, your interactions with people through the heart and crown chakras.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's what I figured. A lot of what's happening, and you're talking about this sort of like continuous loop. I mean, look, it's going on today. These forces are still trying to pull the same old stuff. They're still trying to pull like false flags and the same old tired sort of rhetoric to whip up patriotism to, you know, get another like mass slaughter of innocents going, and people aren't going along with it that well anymore. You know, there's still some people that do.
Yeah, but it's not as organized as it claims to be. And there's this kind of idea when it comes to conspiracy that it's like these people have this like kind of hold on the whole thing. And it's like, no, like you can, one thing that you can extrapolate from that whole wave of LSD was that they had a conception, from what I gather, they had a conception of how this would play out in terms of operating as a distraction from the war that they wanted to get into. How can they use this for their benefit? And from what I gather, it didn't work out the way they had planned. And that's a huge indicator of things. And so when they have to put a stop to something like that, to the best of their ability, it's kind of telling in terms of how much control actually exists on their part, because they have their ideal for how they want to see things play out. And at the same time, everything's happening all at once, because you have these different groups, and they have, every person within that group has a different conception of what the quote-unquote New World Order is supposed to look like, and how they're relating to it. They're not all relating to it the same. They're not on the same page. And that's one of the problems I had with, like, Esoteric Agenda and Zeitgeist, is because there's this kind of assumption that these people are all on the same page, and they're not in agreement, as far as I can tell. Like, people are coming from different places. Some people are actually coming from a really good place in these organizations, even in the CIA. You know, it's not like just the CIA is this evil shadow thing. It's like some of those people actually had a degree of intention for what they were trying to do, and some people had another type of intention, and they are actually coexisting simultaneously. And so what the fuck?
You know? Exactly. Exactly right. There's warring factions within it. There's no doubt.
Right.
No doubt at all. But then even again in the larger thing, right, because the CIA, that was the Nazis and the Jesuits and the Bushes and all that, right? Yeah. And the other side was sort of like the Kennedys were in with like the Dominicans and all that, and they were like trying to shut the CIA down, you know, to from that side. You know, they had like Hoover in the middle who was compromised, but the Kennedys trusted him, and obviously we know history from that point. And even like 9/11, the whole thing behind that, even though I don't even usually talk about this stuff anymore, but that was basically, that was like a coup because, you know, they had already, CIA had already calved off like one third of the military and stuff, and you know, that was basically the reason they shot the missile or whatever it was into the Pentagon. It was basically right. To get the military, the naval commanders, they were actually against that faction. And that was what was in Building 7, those offices that blew out. That's what it was, a coup. They fucking bumped the guys off and blew the shit up. And
sure.
And yeah. Americans go, let's go get that guy that they showed us on TV, you know? It's
like yeah. So so on the show, if we have listeners who have heard this before, fuck it, I'm going to say it again just because I love to share this because I find it so interesting. So you can skip forward if you've heard this and you're tired of it. But anyways, it blew my mind. So basically, I kept on seeing this reference to something in the Zohar that Zohar predicts 9/11. And my immediate response was, okay, whatever, you know, like, but I'm like looking for a reference still, and I look for hours and days, like, trying to find an actual, because I study Zohar with a rabbi, and so when I find something interesting, I bring it to him and we translate it together, because a lot of this stuff and the commentary on it has never been translated into English, and because, I mean, the Zohar is fucking huge, you know, and
right.
So it's good to read it in the actual Aramaic and the Hebrew commentary. And so I finally find a reference that actually is like, okay, this is what they're referring to, that 9/11 is in the Zohar. And so I bring it to my teacher, and he's like, okay, well, he'll entertain the possibility, you know, and we're going along. Three strongholds will fall in Rome, ushering in the end of days, so to speak, or the time that is to come will emerge out of this destruction, and the coming of the Messiah and all this stuff. And so actually it has the 25th of Elul, which in 2001 translated to the 15th of September. And this is supposed to take place at the shift of the millennium, right? It's the idea that 2,000 years, and then you have this time, and then it just so happens to be this date. But so I was like, okay, it's a couple days off. Pretty interesting, though, with the description of it, because you have steel, you know, structures that collapse. And it's like, how many steel structures are there, you know, at this time, you know, at this point, was it the 12th century, you know, Zohar. And so, like, but then I find out shortly thereafter that in the 18th century, there was actually a rabbi who came along and said that it was off by a couple days. And it actually, his interpretation actually translates it to September 11th. And then you say, well, it's millennium, so 2001. It's actually that these three strong, and there is no prophecies in the Zohar. It's very rare. That's why when I brought it up to my teacher, he was like, he's been studying it the better part of his life, and he's never come across a single prophecy like there is in the book of Isaiah or there is in the Tanakh, you know, and with the prophets. And so it just so happens to be a prophecy in the Zohar, and it's very specific, and it happens to be during that time. And so, it really actually totally blew my mind, because it was like, whoa, there it is. And, you know, the European occultists, I've seen it time and time again, where they actually always ascribe to the most recent interpretation. So they don't take the oldest as the authority. They take the newest as the authority. And that's one of the issues with the Golden Dawn, you could say, or maybe that's one of its benefits. I don't really know. Mm-hmm. But I did find that pretty mind-blowing.
It is. It's far. Well, the thing is, it wouldn't surprise me that the people that pulled it off knew that and actually used that.
Sure. And that would explain why it shows up in so much media too, you know, is that if this is an understanding in the inner circle, you know, that they're projecting it. So.
Right, because I saw there was a guy years ago, there was this guy, Kent Farnsworth, or not Kent, what was his last name? I can't think, remember his last name, Kent. But anyway, he ran his cyberspaceorbit.com. It was great. You know, he passed away, probably 8 years ago or something. But he would publish all his stuff. And one of the things that he ran on there for a while was these guys that were showing that 9/11 was this whole, like, cosmic ritual and how the stars were placed behind. Gemini was up behind the towers. Mm-hmm. And it's like, let's go far out. You know, they really do that stuff. You know, it's like, that's that conspiracy stuff. But you start digging deep. No, it's actually ritual, intentional ritualistic.
Yeah, it's Joaquin
for the engineering of consciousness.
It's obvious. I mean, if you look at those towers, you know, I mean, there's a guy, Jay Kotza, I don't know if you're familiar, that's like, we have this whole kind of synchronicity community, and there's certain basic fundamental pieces that have gotten worked in these different ways. And one of them is that when you look at the two towers, symbolically, you're looking at Joaquin and Boaz established in strength. It's where the term Wizard of Oz comes from. I mean, the Oz and Wizard of Oz is a Hebrew word meaning strength, and it's one of the two towers. And so it's very symbolic thing, especially when you see the sphere that was between the two towers was admitted to be a representation of the Kaaba at Mecca. And so that's why they would rotate it every 24 hours, was to have to symbolize the people rotating around the Kaaba. And so once you see that, and you're like, well, this is symbolic of the Holy of Holies. And if you go to the Kaaba, you see these two pillars that are right next to it, you know, and those represent Joaquin and Boaz for the temple. And so to destroy the temple as a trade, like that it's a, you know, you're trading at the temple, it's related to money, and that's not what you're supposed to do. And so it's a very symbolic act in that sense to destroy the temple once again. You have every so many thousand years, we erect this thing, and then it's not supposed to be built by human hands because it's something that we're building on the inner planes, which is the tree of life itself. It's the temple. I mean, that's the thing, is that you have the two pillars of the tree, and then you have the middle pillar, the Holy of Holies, that the tree of life itself is meant to be a representation of Solomon's temple. I mean, that's the meaning. That's why you say Star of David, Seal of Solomon, right? I mean, the tree of life itself is a Star of David divided, so it's a split Adam. The Adam is the star, that's the template. And you divide the template, and out of the space that exists in division, you have Babylon is constructed. That's why Malkut literally translates as empire, because the empire emerges out of this thing. So it's all symbolic. And it's like, if it's real or if it's not real, it's just that these people believe it. And so because they believe it, it carries a certain power, you know. And I don't really know where the line is drawn, you know, but yeah, I mean, what has come out of the destruction of the towers is, you know, on one extreme movement of control, very like Orwellian kind of like surveillance deal and drones and all this stuff. But then simultaneously, you have this movement in consciousness that seems to have emerged out of the thing as well, because people see the show. And more and more people see it as a show. They see it as like this kind of presentation. I mean, this thing that's filmed, you know about the Millennium Hilton that stood in front of the towers?
I'm not sure. Yeah.
There is a building that was right in front of the two towers that is admittedly modeled after the monolith from 2001, A Space Odyssey. And if you watch 2001, A Space Odyssey, when Haywood Floyd is walking down a hallway, you'll see that there's a glass room that says Hilton on it. And there's a guy sitting at a desk that looks an awful lot like the monolith. And there's a little airplane above him, which is kind of weird, but it's like, you know, it's called the Millennium Hilton. It's modeled after the 2001, you know, monolith. It's right there at ground zero, you know. That's the point of consciousness evolution in the film, and it's literally the screen, and everyone's watching this happen on the screen, and it's like, and everyone can see, like, it's such a thing in plain sight. Like, buildings don't fall like that. Anyone with fucking any kind of awareness at all can see that they're watching a demolition project, you know? I mean, I'm sorry, give me a break. Like, I look at that, and I'm like, right. you gotta be fucking kidding me, you know?
Exactly. Not even a normal demolition. That was a high-tech wizardry.
Yeah.
I think they use satellites. I don't know if you've ever come across John Lash's work?
Not familiar, no.
John Lash, he's a Gnostic scholar. You might find his stuff. He wrote books like Not in His Image, or his reinterpretation of like the Nag Hammadi and the Dead Sea Scrolls. He calls it radical pagan feministic Gnosticism. He's got his own approach. He worked with Joanna Harcourt Smith quite a bit, who was actually Joanna Leary, Tim Leary's. But I've actually met John in the past, like almost 30 years ago. Interesting guy. But yeah, his take is he did a thing, he did a chat with Judy Wood about the towers, and he called it Message to the Crop Circle Wizards. And his thesis is that, right, because, I mean, I think the crop circles are probably written by Masers. I think that, you know, symbology is sort of wrong to me. If the Earth was, like, throwing something up or aliens were trying to communicate, they could do a hell of a better job. There's some terrestrial consciousness trying to engineer a certain level of thinking within people over the stuff. But according to John, he thinks that what they're using to write the crop circles is the same stuff at high power was used to disintegrate the towers. I thought, well, whether it's true or not, it's actually an interesting thought.
Yeah, totally.
Yeah. Not that I agree with all these things. I like to think about them.
No, yeah, you speculate. But the thing is that the more that you keep following and you don't take a position, the further you really get. Because this comes up a lot here. It's because we have so many guests and we don't have much of a mission statement. And I might be the one pushing this more than anybody. But I'm so sick of so many podcasts and so many people's kind of like, they get to this place where they come up with this conclusion and then they just keep pushing that at the forefront of their whole deal. And it's like, no, can we just continue to like take the pieces that we know that are like real? Like, okay, we know this, like, you know, there was like, I'm giving this kind of far out example of like the Millennium Hilton, but like, we know that it's modeled after the monolith. We know that Hilton shows up in 2001 A Space Odyssey. We know like that happened in 2001. These are interesting facts. They don't mean anything in it. Like, they don't prove anything. All they are interesting anomalies. It's a phenomenon. And so you continue on with the phenomenon. It's like, I've just more and more, I'm like, take a position. It feels so real. Like, I can't take an ultimate position and be like, this is what all this means. I mean, I could do that, but would that be helpful? Like, could I keep continuing on? Like, it kind of like ends the, I mean, you can keep talking, but in a sense, it ends the conversation.
Right. Well, you brought up a concept earlier, which I think is totally apropos for the point here, is, and that was, you're talking about the reversal in 2001, right? And that's the thing, was you go through an initiatory process. When you get to the next stage, everything you believed in the last stage is like wrong.
Right.
You know, and that's one of the things with like, and you get into like the orgone biophysics, you know, is that, you know, when people, the initiatory process, you know, usually it has to work through people in such a way that it integrates in their being. So when they come into this new level and they realize the other stuff was false, it doesn't sort of, like, to use a technical term, discombobulate their system and they go crazy, right? They need to, you need this like initiatory process to bring people through to where their next level of perspective shows them that their previous perspective may not have been totally wrong, but they no longer see it in that way.
Right.
And that's why I sort of advocate the multiple perspective. That's why I've kind of tried to develop this into a simple sort of four world thing, which I guess I do kind of push that point of view, but I haven't fully been able to explain it all yet. That's what I'm working on, because it's not a singular point. It allows people to see things from all different points.
Right. And, because on this level, this is relatively true. But then on another level, there's another relative truth. And then there's another relative truth. And as long as we're dealing with projection, we're not actually dealing with the reality anyway. So they're all just different angles on the same thing, right? Is that kind of what you're saying? I mean, that
exactly. But as you'll know from your Kabbalistic studies, you know, that there is an underlying archetype. There is something. Otherwise, we wouldn't have these structures. We wouldn't see, like, the golden section forming in living beings and things.
Sure.
In the plant world. So,
totally. Hmm. Yeah, my teacher would make the point that he's like, You can get all of this from a leaf. If you were able to meditate deeply enough on a leaf, you could get it there. Cause, you know, I had a friend visit from Oregon, Patrick Svek, and he's in this whole community, you know, like dealing with this crazy synchronicity stuff. And he's bringing this stuff to the attention of my rabbi, talking about this stuff in multimedia and stuff. And he's like, well, you could find it there. You'll find an order there, but you'll find that same order anywhere if you look deeply enough, or if you know how to look, you know, that it's just going to show up. It's going to manifest itself because there's an underlying principle in nature. But then at the same time, you know, there's people who are aware of that, and then they like throw it back at it, so to speak. Like they're aware of the dynamics of the thing, and so they replicate those dynamics in an artistic way. And that can be helpful if you know what you're looking at to a degree, you know, because you can disseminate information and it works as a tool. You know, it doesn't have to be a manipulative kind of sorcery, though I do think that there's a degree of that that goes on, that there's people with that kind of intention. But I also feel that some of the stuff that's emerging from media isn't always diabolical. Like, I have a hard time buying that there's just these evil people everywhere. You know, I mean, I feel like that's a very fear-based way to interpret Kabbalah. I don't think that that's the meaning of Kabbalah, because when I look at traditionally what the Kabbalists would do is they're looking to reconcile a division in the tree between Seir and the Shekinah, between Tiferet and Malkuth. They're looking to bring these principles back together. They're looking to reunite. They're looking to nullify the Klipot. And then you have some of the more European schools, they're actually looking to strengthen the Klipot for some reason I don't quite understand. Like, they can be coming from completely different places, but then it gets all grouped into that this is Kabbalah. Like, what the hell is Madonna looking at? Like, and that, like, Kabbalistic society, that's not Kabbalah. Like, I look at their stuff, I'm like, this has nothing to do with what I study. You know, what the fuck is this? You know, kind of thing. And it's like, well, you know, are they just all about power? Are they all about, like, the secret? Like, they're looking to, like, manifest things for themselves and take a name and gain power from that name. I'm like, this does not show up in my studies of traditional study of the Zohar from Spanish Kabbalists in the 15th and 16th century. They don't go into that much. And if they do, they're not advocating it. Whereas these people seem to be completely focused on that's what Kabbalah means to them. And so I'm just like, well, you know, you're giving the same thing, you're giving two different things the same name. And that's kind of unfortunate, because it's like, it's not just that it gives it a bad rap, and that's not my problem. My problem is just what's going on, how they're relating to the material doesn't seem to be helpful, even to them, ultimately, you know?
Yeah, well, it's helpful to them, but it's sort of like, you know, calling McDonald's hamburger meat, right?
Right.
It's about 15% of real meat, but the rest of it's like some sort of sludge made to look like meat.
Yes. Yeah. I mean, we had a guest on the show, and it's actually my least favorite episode in the course of 2 years, where it was Jan Irving. And he was so kind of like pushing this view that all of this mysticism stuff is just a means of manipulation or control, or like trying to suppress people's own faculties or something. And I'm just, or to get a one-up on the populace. And I don't rule out the possibility, big time, that there's people that relate to it in that way. But to make the leap across the board and say that's all this is, or that's all it was ever meant to be, I have a really difficult time with. Because I happen to know that a lot of these traditional Kabbalists were actually, they don't seem to be coming from that place. They're actually looking to heal. It's all focused on healing. It's in their writing. You can see that if you study it. Like, they're not... I feel like that's a leap, you know?
Oh, absolutely. Well, I mean, I give Jan credit for actually turning me on to the Trivium years ago.
Sure.
But I would say he certainly doesn't apply it properly in his consciousness. He's very meme-driven. You know, he thinks he's gotten to a certain point, and he drives it home to the point of ridiculousness. You know, it's unfortunate. The guy's almost become a caricature of himself in the way he tries to, like, defend these indefensible, idiotic points of view.
Right, it's a paradox, right? It kind of reminds me of, like, Krishnamurti or something, of what he was pointing out, where it's like, you're doing the thing that you're, like, it's a phenomenon. It's like the thought is doing something, and it's claiming that it's not doing it, kind of thing. It's like, Do you know what I'm trying to communicate here when I say Krishnamurti's deal, where there's a paradox involved, where you're playing something out, and you're projecting it as if you were doing the opposite. It's a weird phenomenon that we do.
I understand exactly.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. Hey, David, I could speak for a few more hours here, but I've got to get on with my day.
You know what, man? That's awesome. I was about to say it myself, but it's been great talking to you. I hope we can do it again in the not too distant future, because this is awesome. If that's okay with you.
Oh, please. No, man. It's fascinating. You've got great depth of knowledge, and we've got, you know, I love having intelligent conversations. That's what I live for. So yeah, I'm very happy to. I went through Western Kabbalah, you know, through like Golden Dawn, you know, like say Israel Regardi, all these guys. But actually, it's been about 30 years since I really studied that. The only thing that I've really carried through was the Four Worlds, which reappeared to me through my sort of etheric and worldview stuff. You've got a good depth knowledge. I just like bouncing ideas around. I'm just happy to have a chat, see where cool. we go.
Awesome. Yeah, and hopefully in the future we can have our other co-host, Alan, on as well, and maybe we can do another like roundtable discussion. I'll look forward to it. I'm glad you're able to make it, and yeah, I look forward to it again.
Cool. Hey, Dave, we'll keep in touch then, man. You take care.
All right, you too. Bye.
All right, see you. Bye.